everyone, and welcome to this deep dive, where we're going to be taking a look at some excerpts from Dr. August Conkle's lectures on the Book of Chronicles.
Okay.
Specifically, we're focusing on King Solomon's reign.
Right.
But there's a twist. Chronicles gives us a very idealized version of Solomon's kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's all peace and prosperity and divine approval.
Yeah.
So our big question today is why?
Mm.
Why does the author present this almost perfect picture?
Right.
What are they trying to tell us?
Well, that's the puzzle we're piecing together here. It's important to remember that Chronicles wasn't written as just a simple historical record.
Yeah.
It's a reflection on the past, shaped by the author's own context and beliefs.
Okay, so we need to think about the why behind the writing.
Exactly.
It's not just about what happened,
right,
but about how the author wants us to see it.
Exactly.
Conkle points out how much the chronicler emphasizes God's role in Solomon's success.
Absolutely. Solomon isn't just a clever king. He's a vessel for God's blessing. His achievements become a testament to God's faithfulness and provision for those who follow him.
And here's where it gets even more interesting. Chronicles doesn't dwell on Solomon's later conflicts or the things that went wrong, unlike some other sources.
Right.
It's like the author is deliberately focusing on the positive, almost like they're presenting a model for good kingship.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It certainly raises the question of the author's intent. Are they trying to offer a blueprint for future leaders, a reminder of what's possible with God's favor,
mm-hmm.
or maybe even a message of hope for a community that's been through tough times?
Right.
It's fascinating to consider.
So we've got this divinely ordained success.
Yeah.
But what does it actually look like in practice?
Well, according to Chronicles, Solomon's kingdom wasn't just some small-time operation.
Mm-hmm.
He was a major player on the international scene.
Exactly. We see him engaging in extensive trade, launching ambitious building projects, and receiving diplomats from all corners of the known world.
Even the Queen of Sheba makes a legendary appearance, drawn by Solomon's reputation.
Oh, we'll definitely get to the Queen of Sheba later.
Oh, yeah.
But first, let's dig into those economic relationships that Chronicles highlights.
Okay.
Conkle mentions a fascinating partnership between Solomon and the Phoenicians up in Lebanon.
Right. The Phoenicians were renowned for their shipbuilding skills and their access to abundant timber.
Okay.
Resources Solomon needed for his grand construction projects. In return, he provided them with grain from the fertile Jezreel Valley.
Makes sense.
It was a classic win-win situation.
Uh-huh.
Each side supplying what the other lacked.
It's like a perfect example of how trade can benefit everyone involved.
Exactly.
And Conkle also points out a close relationship between Solomon and Syria.
Yes. Although the specifics of that relationship aren't detailed in this particular lecture.
Okay.
It definitely leaves us with some intriguing questions. What kind of exchange was happening there? What did each kingdom bring to the table?
Right.
We'll have to keep exploring to uncover those answers.
Okay, so we've got Solomon the builder, the international diplomat, the divinely favored king.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget the sheer scale of these ancient projects.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to build a massive temple or palace with limited tools and technology.
Right.
Talk about a challenge.
It's mind-boggling when you think about the logistics involved. The sheer manpower required would have been enormous.
And that brings us to a concept that Conkle calls the mass, which was essentially conscripted labor.
Right.
It makes you wonder, how did they organize and manage such huge workforces? What were the conditions like for those laborers?
Yeah.
It's a glimpse into a very different world.
And there's a curious discrepancy between how Chronicles and the Book of Kings handle this issue of conscripted labor.
Oh, really?
Kings suggest that Israelites were also conscripted for the temple building, while Chronicles claims it was only non-Israelites.
What do you make of that difference?
Hmm.
Why would the chronicler present it this way?
It's a fascinating nuance. Perhaps the chronicler wanted to portray Solomon as being more sensitive to the needs of his own people.
Okay.
Or maybe it's a subtle way of emphasizing the distinction between Israelites and foreigners.
Right.
It's hard to say for sure.
Yeah.
But it definitely raises some questions about the author's agenda.
It's like we're getting these little glimpses into the author's priorities and the message they're trying to convey.
Yeah.
But beyond the building projects and international dealings, Chronicles also gives us a window into Solomon's reign through the lens of a specific religious festival.
Okay.
The Feast of Tabernacles.
This was a major annual event taking place in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time of great celebration and thanksgiving, coming right after the Day of Atonement, when the temple and the people had been ritually purified.
So picture this. The temple is freshly cleansed. People are gathering from all over the kingdom. There's a sense of renewal and unity in the air.
Yeah.
It must have been quite a spectacle.
It was a powerful symbol of Solomon's role as a religious leader, uniting his people in their devotion to God. The chronicler uses this vivid imagery to highlight the spiritual dimension of Solomon's reign.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about political power or economic success. It's about fostering a right relationship with God.
And that right relationship seems to extend beyond Israel's borders because Chronicles also emphasizes Solomon's maritime prowess.
Yes.
We're not just talking about coastal trading here. He had trade routes stretching across vast distances.
Both to the west, likely with the help of those skilled Phoenician sailors.
Right.
And also down south on the Gulf of Aqaba and the Red Sea.
Here's where it gets really mind-blowing. These weren't quick trips. Conkle mentions that voyages could take up to 3 years due to wind patterns and seasons.
Wow.
Can you imagine setting sail on a journey that might last for years?
It's a testament to the ambition and the logistical challenges of ancient seafaring.
Yeah.
Those voyages would have required immense planning, courage, and a deep understanding of the natural world.
Mm.
It makes you wonder about the cultural exchanges that must have happened along those trade routes, too. What kind of knowledge and ideas were being shared across those vast distances?
It's like we're getting a glimpse into a globalized world centuries before we usually think of globalization.
Exactly.
And speaking of fascinating encounters, who doesn't love a good royal visit?
Right.
Enter the Queen of Sheba. But we'll save that story for the next part of our deep dive.
Okay.
Welcome back. We're deep in the Book of Chronicles, exploring this carefully crafted image of King Solomon as the ideal ruler.
Right.
Peaceful, prosperous, divinely favored.
Mm.
But is that the whole story?
Yeah, that's the question that keeps us digging deeper.
Right.
Remember, Chronicles was written centuries after the events it describes.
Right.
It's not a straightforward historical account,
mm-hmm.
but a reflection on the past, shaped by the author's own context and concerns.
We can't just take it at face value. We need to think about why the chronicler chose to emphasize certain things and leave others out.
Right.
What message were they trying to convey to their audience?
One possibility is that they were offering a vision of hope and restoration. Imagine a community that's been through exile, hardship, and loss.
Right.
Solomon's glorious reign becomes a model for what could be again.
Mm-hmm.
A reminder that God's blessing is still possible, even after tragedy.
So Solomon's story becomes a source of inspiration, a blueprint for rebuilding and restoring what was lost.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder, what were the specific challenges facing the chronicler's community?
Yeah.
What did they need to hear?
That's a question worth pondering.
Right.
And it might help explain why the chronicler downplayed Solomon's later failings and focused so heavily on the positive aspects of his reign.
Right.
It's like they're saying, look, this is what we're capable of. This is the kind of leader God can raise up. And this is the kind of prosperity God can bestow upon us if we remain faithful.
It's a powerful message of resilience and hope rooted in a reimagined past. But even within that idealized portrait, there are these little hints, these subtle cracks that suggest things weren't always so perfect.
Uh-huh.
Remember those epic 3-year voyages we talked about?
Yeah.
The source mentions some pretty unusual cargo, gold, silver, ivory, sure,
yeah.
but also apes and peacocks.
Quite a list, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Those exotic animals would have been incredibly rare and valuable in the ancient world.
Right.
More than just basic commodities. They were likely status symbols, prized possessions for the wealthy and elite.
So it's not just about meeting basic needs. It's about showcasing Solomon's wealth, his sophistication.
Right.
His access to the rarest and most sought after goods in the world.
Exactly.
It's another way of demonstrating his power and influence on a global scale.
Precisely. It adds another layer to our understanding of Solomon's kingdom and its impact. And speaking of power, we touched on Solomon's military capabilities, specifically his cavalry. Those horses didn't just appear out of thin air, you know.
Right.
They had to be acquired and maintained, which required resources and strategic alliances.
Conkle mentioned that Solomon traded with Egypt and regions in southern Turkey to obtain horses and training.
Mm-hmm.
It shows his strategic thinking, his ability to forge connections with key players, and his willingness to invest in the security of his kingdom.
Remember, this was a time of constant warfare and shifting alliances. Maintaining a strong military wasn't just about showing off. It was essential for survival. But it's interesting how Chronicles presents Solomon's military strength as a natural extension of his God-given wisdom and blessing.
It's all part of that carefully constructed image of the ideal king, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's wise. He's just He's prosperous and he's got a powerful army to protect it all.
Right.
It's like the ultimate package deal.
And for the Chronicler's audience, that image must have been incredibly appealing. It's a vision of stability, security, and divine favor, something they likely longed for after years of turmoil and uncertainty.
It's a reminder that even in the darkest of times, there's hope for restoration and renewal, and that hope is often grounded in a reinterpretation of the past, a way of finding meaning and inspiration in the stories of those who came before us.
Right.
But let's not forget that Chronicles isn't just a dry historical account.
Oh.
The storytelling itself is quite masterful, full of vivid details and dramatic moments that really bring the past to life.
You're absolutely right. Take the Queen of Sheba's visit, for example. The Chronicler doesn't just tell us she was impressed. We get this detailed description of the royal pageantry, the ceremonial shields, the magnificent throne.
It's like we're right there with her experiencing the splendor and opulence of Solomon's court.
Exactly.
You can almost hear the music, smell the incense, feel the weight of expectation in the air.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder, what was the Queen of Sheba really thinking as she witnessed all this?
Those details aren't just there for entertainment value. They reinforce that sense of awe and wonder, underscoring Solomon's greatness and the divine blessing that rests upon him. It's all carefully crafted to inspire and uplift the audience.
And it works centuries later. We're still captivated by these stories. But here's what really intrigues me. Like, Chronicles doesn't shy away from the fact that Solomon's reign wasn't always perfect.
Right.
There are these hints of trouble brewing, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
It's like a shadow lurking beneath the surface of all that splendor.
You're referring to the conflict with Jeroboam, I presume.
Exactly. This figure emerges from the shadows and casts a long shadow over Solomon's legacy. It's like a subtle crack in the facade of this seemingly perfect reign.
Jeroboam starts out as one of Solomon's top officials, a trusted leader. But then there's this cryptic mention of him lifting up his hand against the king.
It's almost a throwaway line in Chronicles.
Yeah.
But it's clearly setting the stage for some major drama. Remember, this is the same Jeroboam who will later lead the northern tribes of Israel to break away and form their own kingdom.
Right.
He's a pivotal figure.
So even though Chronicles focuses on the idealized image of Solomon's united and prosperous kingdom,
yeah,
there are these hints that it wasn't all smooth sailing. The seeds of division were already being sown.
And that makes you wonder, what led to this rift? Was it just personal ambition on Jeroboam's part, or were there deeper issues at play? What would cause someone to rebel against a leader like Solomon?
Some scholars suggest that there was growing discontent among the northern tribes. They felt marginalized, burdened by heavy taxes to support Solomon's grand projects.
Right.
And perhaps even resentful of the lavish attention he lavished on Jerusalem and the temple.
It's a classic story, isn't it? Even in a kingdom blessed by God, there can be inequalities and tensions simmering beneath the surface. Mm. And those tensions can erupt, especially when there's a charismatic leader like Jeroboam waiting in the wings.
It reminds us that even the most successful leaders face challenges, and that unity is a fragile thing, easily fractured by internal divisions and unmet needs.
So what happens next? Does Chronicles give us any more clues about this showdown between Solomon and Jeroboam?
Not really.
Does it tell us how this lifting up of the hand played out?
It simply states that Jeroboam lifted up his hand against the king and then fled to Egypt for safety. It leaves us with more questions than answers.
Okay, so not exactly a blow-by-blow account, but it's enough to pique our curiosity. What was the nature of this rebellion? Was it an assassination attempt? An open revolt? Chronicles invites us to fill in the blanks to imagine the drama unfolding behind the scenes.
And that's part of the brilliance of the text. It allows us to engage with the story on multiple levels, to ponder the complexities of power, ambition, and loyalty, and to consider how even the most glorious reigns can be marked by internal conflict and the potential for downfall.
So Jeroboam flees to Egypt, seeking refuge from Solomon's wrath. But this isn't the last we hear of him. In fact, his story takes an even more intriguing turn when we consider what happens next.
Yes, things get even more complicated when we realize that Jeroboam finds refuge with the Egyptian pharaoh Shishak.
Okay.
And guess what? Shishak later launches an attack on Jerusalem during the reign of Solomon's son Rehoboam.
Wait, so Jeroboam teams up with the Egyptians to attack his own people? That's a pretty bold move, to say the least, what would drive someone to such extremes.
It certainly suggests a deep-seated resentment towards Solomon and his dynasty. Perhaps he felt betrayed, unjustly punished, or simply saw an opportunity to seize power for himself, whatever his motives. This alliance with Egypt sets the stage for the dramatic events that will unfold in the next chapter of the story.
All right, listeners, get ready for a plot twist, because it seems like this idealized kingdom is about to face its biggest test yet. As we move into the reign of Rehoboam, we'll see how those simmering tensions boil over, leading to a divided kingdom and a new era of conflict and uncertainty.
It's a stark reminder that even the most carefully constructed legacies can crumble under the weight of internal strifes and external pressures, and that even in the face of divine blessing, human choices have the power to shape the course of history.
The story of Solomon and Jeroboam is a cautionary tale about the fragility of power, the allure of ambition, and the enduring consequences of broken trust. As we continue our deep dive into the Book of Chronicles, keep those themes in mind. Pay attention to the subtle hints, the unspoken tensions, the moments where the idealized facade starts to crack, because that's where the real story lies.
And who knows? You might uncover insights that even the chronicler didn't intend to reveal. That's the beauty of a deep dive. There's always something new to discover, always another layer to peel back. Thanks for joining us on this journey into the world of King Solomon. We'll see you in the next part as we explore what happens when Rehoboam takes the throne.
Welcome back to the show. We've been really getting deep into this idealized portrait of King Solomon.
Yeah, a reign full of divine favor and dazzling achievements, but with that little hint of something else going on underneath.
Exactly. And it always brings us back to Jeroboam.
Oh, yeah. He casts a long shadow over Solomon's legacy.
We left off with him going to Egypt after that whole lifting up of the hand incident.
Yeah. And it wasn't just any old incident.
No, this is the same Jeroboam who ends up leading those northern tribes to break away and make their own kingdom.
It's huge. His rebellion really set off this whole chain of events that reshapes the politics and religion of the whole region.
Even though Chronicles paints this picture of Solomon's kingdom as this perfect united thing, it keeps hinting at these tensions brewing under the surface.
Right.
It makes you think, what caused all this? Was Jeroboam just power hungry, or was there something more?
Well, think about the context. Solomon's reign had all those massive building projects.
Right.
Huge government bureaucracy and taxes and labor conscription. All that stuff made the kingdom look successful, but it put a real strain on the people, especially up north.
So maybe it wasn't just Jeroboam being ambitious. Maybe he was giving a voice to those who felt ignored or like they were carrying too much of the burden.
It's very possible. And it shows that even the best leaders can have unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And that unity is fragile, especially when there are inequalities that haven't been dealt with.
Like that saying, power corrupts. Even Solomon wasn't immune.
It's true.
Yeah.
But let's get back to Jeroboam. He's in Egypt hiding out from Solomon. What happens next?
Right.
Things get even more interesting here.
Yeah.
He gets in good with the Egyptian pharaoh, Shishak.
Okay.
And remember, Egypt had always been a rival to Israel. They saw Solomon getting stronger as a threat.
Right. They wouldn't be happy about that.
No. So they were ready to support anyone who might weaken him.
So Jeroboam's caught in this bigger game.
Right.
He's got his own ambitions, his problems with Solomon, and now this foreign power trying to use him.
Exactly. And it all comes to a head when Shishak attacks Jerusalem during Rehoboam's reign.
Solomon's son.
Yeah. Rehoboam's young and inexperienced, not like his dad.
Oh, he doesn't have Solomon's wisdom.
No. So now Jeroboam's not only got Egypt on his side, he's also facing a much weaker Israel.
That's not going to end well.
And it doesn't. The Egyptians win. They loot Jerusalem. Mm. Rehoboam has to give in. Solomon's once great kingdom is now broken and weak.
What a turnaround. It really shows that even the best built legacies can fall apart.
Absolutely. It all comes down to leadership.
Yeah.
Even a king chosen by God can mess things up for everyone.
And it makes you wonder if Solomon himself was partly to blame.
Yeah, did his policies, his desire for grandeur, end up causing the kingdom to fall apart?
It's a good question to think about as we wrap up our deep dive into Solomon's reign.
It's a story with high points and low points, and it gives us a glimpse into how complicated leadership and power really are.
And it reminds us that even though it's an ancient story, it still matters today. We face those same issues of ambition and keeping things together.
Exactly. We see it in our own politics, our communities, our own lives.
The story of Solomon and Jeroboam makes us think about the choices we make and how they affect everyone else.
Yeah, thanks for coming along with us on this deep dive into Chronicles.
There's so much more to this book.
Oh, yes, so much.
But we hope this encourages you to keep exploring and keep asking questions.
You never know what you might find when you really dig deep.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening.